Good afternoon and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 15th, 1999. In Quinnah, near Creekside, we have this afternoon Jennifer McCurd, Technology and Ethics, Ethics and Reproductive Technologies, tape number 99-2. Let's listen in.
Well, it is 3:45, so I'm Jennifer McCrickard. I teach philosophy at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. My area of specialty in philosophy is ethics, and most of the work I've been doing recently has been on healthcare ethics. I have also recently become very interested in technology and ethics for a number of reasons. One is that I have friends who are on both ends of the spectrum in terms of technology is the most wonderful thing to have ever happened, two people who think that technology is absolutely evil. And then I point out that they read books, and then they work under lights, and they use pencils and papers and stuff like that. So that's the one reason I'm interested in technology and ethics. The other is that most people I run into who don't know much about the field of ethics, they want to ask me questions about technology. So what do I think about cloning? What do I think about the internet? All sort of stuff. So it's stuff that many people who are not in academia are also interested in. What I tell my students on the first day of class is that if I have succeeded throughout the semester, they will leave my course far more confused, far more frustrated, and with far more questions than they had at the beginning of the semester. And they usually get this look of fear on their faces. But they usually stick with it, and true to my prediction, they usually are more frustrated and more confused and have more questions at the end of the semester. But they realized that at the beginning of the semester, they had far more confidence in their beliefs than they actually should have had. And so I spent the semester sort of actually trying to rattle them and say, you may not be quite as smart as you think you are at the tender age of 19. At the age of 32, that's when you'll have all the truth. So it is, and part of the reason that I tell you that is to preempt any accusations at the end of this 60 minutes when you say, oh, but I don't think that I now know anything more than I knew at the beginning of the 60 minutes, and in fact, I think I might know a little bit less. That would be a sign that I've actually done something well. So when I've written up here on the board, say, isn't it nice to define failure as success. What I've written up here in terms of moral and immoral are three different ways that people go about within philosophical ethics, and I don't think this is too different from theological ethics, in terms of assessing what makes something moral or immoral. Now, there's a whole other field within ethics where we talk about how we justify which of these is the correct way to do to determine what's moral and immoral, and that gets us into some fairly highfalutin, highly theoretical philosophy, which you probably gouging your eyes out in about 20 minutes if we actually try to do that. So I'm just going to tell you what these are, and what I'm going to really push us to do this during the 60 minutes is be consistent. Philosophers have this little thing where we believe that everybody ought to be consistent on the positions that they take. The first reason that many people will say that something is moral or immoral is with regard to whether or not a particular act conforms to or violates a right or a duty. So if somebody says that lying is wrong, they might say that the reason that it is wrong to lie is because everybody has to hear the truth. And if you lie to me, you are violating my right to hear the truth. Or somebody might say that the reason that it's wrong to lie is not that I have a right to hear the truth, but that you have a duty to tell the truth. In an ethics class, we spend weeks on this, but we're going to spend about 2 minutes. Another reason, and a very different reason, for believing that something might be wrong is because of the consequences. Or that something might be right because of the consequences. Somebody who thinks that lying is wrong because of the consequences would say, in this case, it was wrong to lie to you because it had negative consequences, or it would have negative consequences. One of the things about appealing to consequences is that something could be right under some circumstances and wrong under other circumstances, because depending on the circumstances, that's going to determine what the consequences are. In this case, it's typically much more absolute in terms of it is either always wrong or always right. Consequences is going to depend upon the situation. The last one I have here is that something is moral or immoral because it exemplifies a specific virtue or a specific vice. And I, in fact, used this reasoning the other day when Jim's son was going to try and do something where he would have to fudge on the truth a little bit. It'd be a nice way of saying lie. And he asked, well, why can't I lie? And Jim deferred to me to explain it to him. So I had this dream, and I thought, well, what's going to make the most sense? I mean, this young man had spent most of the time playing Star Wars stuff, and doing lots of Luke Skywalker and part of the Jedi and all that sort of stuff. So I appealed to virtues and vices by saying, okay, a Jedi Knight would not lie, because a Jedi Knight believes in honor and all of those sort of stuff. And he, of course, gave me all these examples from the movie where the Jedi Knights actually did lie. back and forth on that one a little bit. And he actually came back a couple of days later, and we talked about it some more, and I said, okay, well, what sort of man do you want to grow up and be like? Who do you want to be? Do you want to be a man of honor, a man of truth, or do you want to be the sort of man who lies to get what he wants? Okay, I get it. And he did admit that Yoda never would have lied. So talking about something exemplifying a virtue or a vice turns more on the character of the agent. Okay? And the reason that I put these three up here is because I suspect that as I go over here and ask you about the morality of these different things and different arguments that you hear, we're probably going to be drawing on basically these three different types of theories. Now, much to the frustration of my students and possibly frustration of all of you, my classes are very interactive. So now it's your job. It's your turn to do some work. But what I want to just have you all tell me is, what sorts of arguments do you hear out there in the world about why these different reproductive technologies are either moral or immoral, why they should be done or why they shouldn't be done? And I assume that any of you have any interaction with newspapers or television, you've heard something about these things.
So the sake of the tape, you should probably say that.
Oh, and the things that are up on the board are artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization, fertility drugs, and cloning. So have you heard any discussions about whether these things are moral or immoral in the
media? Well, at least in the first three, it would. Yeah. I think we could apply that because of the consequences that these gross techniques would permit a infertile couple, perhaps, or children.
Okay, so actually, all three would allow an infertile couple.
Yeah, that's what I meant. All three.
Or I mean, all four.
All four.
All four would allow an infertile couple to have children also.
Oh, I don't know that.
But, okay, so the positive consequences of having genetically related. And I know you didn't say genetically related, but.
No, I didn't apply it.
Okay. What are some other arguments that are out there in the world, either for or against these different reproductive technologies?
We have a population problem and sometimes a fertility drug causes multiple births.
Okay, so we have population concerns. And then what was the second one?
Oh, I was just saying because of the multiple births.
Okay.
That are possible.
Okay, so population concerns with regards to multiple births. That'll come up probably most with the fertility drugs.
Which simply it's not natural.
Okay. With cloning, we're finding, well, the last thing I read was that cloned, like the sheep and everything, tend to have a much shorter lifespan.
Okay, so
they're aging very rapidly. Mm-hmm.
Cloning,
aging. We're playing
gosh. Sheep, from whose cell it was taken. Not knowing the consequences of these activities in the long run.
You can't care for seven babies as well as you care for one.
Okay. Oh my gosh, there aren't a whole lot of positives, are there? I'll just.
related to that, the expense of having multiple, deliver six or seven or eight kids, figure $100,000 apiece.
And then the first affects a lot of them.
Yes.
Some people also talk about the expense of going to fertility treatments. It's very expensive. Some states do, have laws about that the insurance must support IVF, but a lot of states don't, and so some people think, it really is about a 20% chance of that in vitro. Maybe that's better to use it for the actual children who are living.
But does it cost more than $20,000 to adopt a child?
It costs,
oh, yes.
Yes.
You can.
And you can.
$200,000. What kind of child?
Depends.
Jen, some of the positive things is it expands options, particularly for couples or individuals who would not otherwise be able to conceive.
I would argue that $200,000 for Chinese babies.
Well, if it's a bad.
Well, our friends didn't do more than $40,000 total.
I think it probably depends on which sort of agency you go through.
Yeah,
and how quickly you want the child.
Okay, I'm saying, doesn't it cost more to adopt a child than it does to spend money for a fertility?
Right, so in terms of consistency, if you're going to say that the problem with any of these treatments is that it's too expensive, well, then it seems like you have to also say that adoption is also immoral because it's even more expensive.
But on the other hand, in one case, you have a child that's already in the world. On the other hand, you're spending the money to create a new child. So, those are somewhat two different.
Right, but then the issue isn't merely the expense. There's something else that's going on.
But it's also not just, it's the expense for the possibility of a child. It's not even, it's 1 in 5 is the success rate most of the time with IVF. So it's spending the money for the possibility of the child where, as the other way, you're spending money for an actual child. Some people get into real distinctions about if it's the semen and the egg of the parents in a marriage, then that's where it's kind of seen, those things are seen as okay because it's kind of a reflection of that couple. But when you start doing donor eggs and donor sperm and I don't know, there's all kinds of complicated ways to think about that, positive and negative.
Right, because what you could get with some of these, if you introduced that the genetic material is being donated, with something like in vitro fertilization, you could actually end up with 4 parents. You'd have the two, or actually you could end up with 5 parents if you use surrogate motherhood, because you'd have the social father, that is the person who is going to raise the child. You would have the social mother, assuming it's a heterosexual couple. You would have the woman who donated the egg, the man who donated the sperm, and then another woman who gestated the fetus. So then you get into a whole myriad. But what I want to focus on is the technologies, not necessarily the different permutations, although it's really difficult to separate all those. I think we have a bunch of the good reasons against these technologies up on the board. Do you think that these are compelling? Do you think that these reasons are good reasons for saying that any of these reproductive technologies are immoral or ought not to be used? And I'll just tell you ahead of time that what I'm going to push is that all of these are perfectly moral and that there isn't anything that's intrinsically wrong with any of these. Maybe certain circumstances where these things ought not to be done or where society ought not to be paying for it, but that there is nothing that is intrinsically wrong with any of these. But I'll just give you a sort of taste of where I'm probably going to go. Unless you all go there and I'll go somewhere else.
This may not be technical enough for you, but we see the results that, where people do have their babies. But what we very often don't hear about are, it's like 20% of the people actually manage to do this. The 80% that are kept going to the doctor for year after year after year and trying procedure after procedure. And I just see this building up of hopes and dashing of hopes to be really, really hard on the human spirit. And I don't know what the moral implications of that are. I know it's very hard on a marriage. And you wonder sometimes if people should, again, this isn't technical, if they should just say, so we are not going to conceive children and look on. Because I've just seen it be so hard for people to build up that hope. And
so it could be emotionally healthy. But I can think of lots of examples where you could say, you know, you really ought to stop trying to ride a motorcycle because you keep falling off.
Write the book.
You know.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
they have the right to.
I can say, you know, it might be better off for your psyche if you stop trying to do this because you're breaking your bones and it doesn't seem to be working out very well for you. But to go this step further and say that it would be immoral for them to keep on riding the motorcycle seems to me to be another stretch.
It is.
So you can say that it's...
Well, it depends on whose money you're spending.
Yeah.
If you're spending your own money when you break your bones, that's fine. But there are limited resources in the world. So if we're going to spend $250,000 to fix your broken bones and you're going to get back on the motorcycle again, well, gee, you know, maybe the rest of us might get together and think about some other way we'd like to spend this money. Maybe childhood immunization programs. And apply the same argument, you know. The docs want to, you know, picking up on my wife's argument about the strain on one's psyche, you know, the docs want to sell us services. If you want to buy them, they want to sell. Because that's how people make their money.
And if I want to buy it. I mean, I think that there are two different things going on.
It depends on whose money you're spending.
But then there's the question of, if I do something which I actually believe to be profoundly stupid, like bungee cord jumping, I can't fathom why anybody would actually want to do this. But if I do it, and I break an arm or something, do we say then that the state shouldn't pay for my broken arm because I was doing something that most people would agree was a stupid thing to be doing? I mean, because very quickly you're going to get onto this slippery slope where we're going to say nobody should get any public money, or the only sort of public money you should get would be if something completely unpredictable and completely unavoidable happens, like a satellite falling out of the sky on your head.
Yeah, well, public money for elective procedures that seem to have a low success rate.
Okay.
Well, but you could say if you work really stupidly hard and you die of a heart attack or you have a terrible heart condition and it has to be paid for, it makes me mad that person doesn't know he or she shouldn't work so hard. You know, I mean, I think that's a hard path to get down.
But I do, I think along the same line in terms of the multiple births and the low birth weight and then the incredible expense to keep these preemies living. And something to me is wrong with that idea for one family maybe, and then that all the support that they'll need indefinitely.
If they have private insurance, that takes care of it,
Would that take care of like 7 babies?
Probably not 7 babies, but 7 babies is typically
But private insurance just spreads the burden around to the other.
Still paying for it.
Someone's paying for it. Yeah.
But what you're talking about, the children, kind of just a concern for the children, they're there, and then they need all this help. So the consequence is that many, many people must take care of these children that, you know, maybe a couple could have taken care of more.
If you said all of those things are moral, could you make the argument that abortion, people say we should not allow abortion because it's playing God. Don't we do the same thing here? I mean, God maybe didn't want this person, this child to die. Does God want this person to be created?
Both the playing God argument and the non-natural argument are very difficult arguments to actually keep up. Because, I mean, we're sitting under fluorescent fluorescent lights, which as far as I know are profoundly unnatural. We're sitting at tables which to my knowledge don't occur in nature. I'm wearing clothes, I was born naked. So there are lots of things that we surround ourselves with that are not natural. And so the not natural argument starts to fall apart pretty quickly in terms of telephones, microwaves, all that sort of stuff. Now some people might say, okay, fine, Jennifer, I will be consistent, and yes, clothing is immoral. But I'm not sure how many folks really want to go that way. In terms of playing God, you still get the question of, well, how do we figure out what God wants us to be doing? I think that's been an age-old question, one that I'm not qualified to answer by any stretch of the imagination. But something by the name of Ted Peters, I'm sure you're fairly well aware of, he's argued that playing God has this huge rhetorical force. You say, ooh, playing God, no, I would never want to do that, gosh, no. But he argues that, in fact, sometimes it is okay to play God, and that we are working with God. And so what we need to do is we need to be very deliberate and make good decisions about how we play God, or how we co-create with God. But it's not clear that doing these sorts of things is wrong, even if it is playing God. Does that make sense?
One of the other problems with playing God is you kind of have to have a notion of what you think God is like, or what God is about, and what God thinks is important. And so, you see, I mean, your theology can really have interesting moral consequences as you go about playing God.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and then with medical issues, like I know a woman, she's afraid to go to a fertility specialist, just to even kind of see what's wrong, because she thinks it's playing God. But if she had a heart condition, you know, maybe just her tubes are blocked. Maybe there's something very simple. But she thinks it's sort of playing God in relation to fertility. But she would obviously go to a doctor. She had to have a bypass or some other thing, which is also just kind of looking at your medical condition.
And the other interesting thing in terms of the playing God argument, there actually is, it's not a position that I agree with, but there is a consistent argument where you can say that things like fertility drugs are permissible ways of playing God, whereas things like abortion are not permissible, because fertility drugs are bringing life into the world, and God puts God's seal of approval on bringing life into the world. But taking life out of the world is the sort of thing that God doesn't like. And in fact, the McCoys, who are in Iowa, they have been played up as the penultimate Christians. They had 7 children at one time, and the reason that they didn't terminate any of the fetuses was because it would be playing God, and God didn't want them to do that. And all of the media said, well, where was that theory as you walk into the fertility specialist? But I think that that could be maintained if you talk about bringing life into the world versus taking life out of the world.
You're right.
Voluntary one of the other, just in terms of looking at who's going to pay for these things, and I don't want to get too sidetracked on that, because I'm not sure. What's interesting is that as these things become more common, they become more likely to be funded by the government, just because they're more accepted, they become safer, etc. One of the concerns I have, just in terms of social justice, is that if the government doesn't pay for these things, what you end up with is very wealthy people who are having pregnancy problems or fertility problems get to have children, whereas poor people who are having fertility problems don't get to have children. I'm not sure if that's a compelling argument, but that's a concern of mine, that it seems to be a very easy way to start saying that certain social classes can't have children.
Well, that's one of the things that, like on artificial insemination, it's either a nightmare or a gift of God, depending on whether you like lesbian parenting or oppose lesbian parenting. But for the lesbian community, artificial insemination has opened up so many options about creating families that many in the lesbian community see this purely positive. People who oppose homosexual parenting, so it would say what's good for heterosexuals or might say there, but would draw the line at homosexual parenting.
Right. Part of the reason that I put
or single parenting too.
Right. Part of the reason that I put in vitro fertilization up here, well, these both of these up here is in contrast to these two, particularly cloning, because I suspect that many of you recall when in vitro fertilization first began, people were just horrified. They thought it was just going to be the downfall of civilization as we know it, that it was going to lead to all of these horrible, horrible consequences. And if you look at a lot of the, lots of the clips about cloning, they're virtually identical arguments in terms of all of the horrible consequences that are going to come about. But anyway, what are some other thoughts?
Well, I don't know what people do think about, because a lot of ethicists seem to make a distinction. If it's the parent's egg and sperm, then the artificial insemination in vitro, it's okay because you're working together as a couple. And but once you start putting in that artificial, not the donor egg or the donor sperm, you've kind of got another person entering the marriage. And like Gil Nylander talks about how, you know, that this having a child together is sort of a, there's a kind of equality there. Each has contributed to this being, and once you add a third party, it's a little bit skewed. And he'd say at that point you should maybe adopt a child, because it's then still kind of an equal thing. You have this child from, you know, you both in a sense adopted. When you have a donor egg or a donor sperm, you have one that's kind of given the genetic material, and the other sort of adopting in a sense. And he thinks that he has some ramifications for the notion of the marriage itself, for also the child, because 50% of couples who do, you know, either have a donor egg or sperm don't tell the child, this is with a heterosexual couple, don't tell the child that it has a different genetic kind of donation here. And then people have questions about that. Is that ethical to kind of not tell a child the full kind of background, genetic background of the child? Is there something about their identity? Well, so I don't know. I just wonder what people think about that
issue. I think that is a big issue, mm-hmm. because children that were adopted in the 60s and earlier, the agencies did not realize it was really important to send with these children as much medical history on parentage as possible, and it impacts the child later. And the same would be true, you know, if the child has no way of knowing about its genetic background, what to expect as mm-hmm. things pop up, and if something is genetic.
Mm-hmm. So maybe if we said, okay, we will tell the child that, you know, they've been a donor egg or a donor sperm here. What do people think about that still? Do they think that's a positive way to go?
Marcia, how would you compare that with, say, if the issue of blended families? Because that's something society's dealt with for a long time, where one parent is the biological parent, the other parent is the parent by marriage. Mm-hmm. Now, oftentimes there's still another biological parent someplace else, but not always. But, I mean, and there are interesting statistics about, you know, the kind of treatment children get when you're not biologically related. It's oftentimes there is a higher incidence of abuse and things with step-parenting, not, mm-hmm. not inevitably, but still that's an issue that, you know, societies have had to deal with for a long time, and we seem to sanction that as an okay thing, mm-hmm. but perhaps no less than ideal.
Mm-hmm. But at least those children know who their biological parent is.
Mm-hmm. I think I would take the position that any policy you would take in adoption is the same policy you would take in this case, so that at some point the child should know its origins, or, you know, as you would with an adopted child, to at some point say, well, we did adopt you, and we don't know who your parents are. And in this situation, I would personally argue against breaching confidentiality. I would hope that the parent, the couple seeking IVF, would not know who the donor of the egg or the sperm is. Personally, I think that really should be a confidential thing. Otherwise, it does bring this third party in.
Do you have friends that are adopted? Or are you? I mean, I have a 45-year-old friend that. that would give anything in the world to know who her real parents are.
I have an adopted grandson, and he is the 18th. He has the opportunity to
and that's what I mean.
People in the old days didn't.
But that's what I'm saying is to have that sort of that for a long period of time it would be confidential and that the parents might not know, but that the child could learn later who the donor is. But ultimately, I don't think it would be I wouldn't argue the morality of assisted IVF on the basis of a like that first one conforms to or violates a right or a duty. I wouldn't take a deontological approach against it and say, well, it's just wrong. It violates scripture, blah, blah, blah. Because I'm not sure you could say that. I mean, look at Deuteronomy, choose life. You know, here you have two people that desperately want to bring life into the world, and that's pretty good. That's a good thing to have. There are a lot
of Bible's original model in surrogate parenting.
Yes.
That's what life is in for you. You have to bring in the sister, right. Bring in the handmaid.
Well, I know. And on the one hand, you think, daughter ain't no problem. Look at, Abraham and Sarah. Okay.
Yeah. But look at Leah and Rachel. Boy, my goodness. They just had now competition. And they were bringing their handmaids.
My issue with it is the expense. And the overtime, that's a lot of money. And I certainly think it should be private money that goes into it. Mm-hmm. And then, so ultimately, I think the morality of it comes down into the next one, under character, and that human beings, we just have to trust people to make the right decisions and to do the best thing, and I can live with that. I'm not going to stand in judgment of someone who does that or doesn't do that. I'm not there to choose.
So in terms of cost, I mean, all of these. As they become, I mean, this is the frequent argument is that if it's made private for long enough, they'll perfect the treatment and it will become cheap enough for just about everybody to do it. So once it became cheap enough, then you wouldn't have a problem with any of these. So basically, if you're going to appeal to the consequences, and you were talking about trusting the character, but it seemed to me that you were also appealing to consequences in terms of cost,
right.
that if you can get rid of the consequences, or the negative consequences, yeah. Then the act should be okay. Is that?
Yes.
Push us on cloning, Jennifer.
Yeah, I have a question about consequences. Maybe it's inconsequential. We recently read this wonderful story about the mother who gave the black child she delivered to the father that had donated the eggs because she had twin boys, one black and one white. Wow, the consequences of that are incredible. She raised this child for months. She wants her son to know he has a twin brother, but they aren't going to be raised in the same way.
I think that those sorts of stories, at least for me, have an incredible emotional pull, because you see the kids on TV being separated and they're hysterical and stuff like that. But surprisingly, from the stuff that I've read, and perhaps Chuck can, since he's a psychologist, who might know a little bit more about this, that the kids who actually experience this don't appear to be severely traumatized as they go on in life. Now granted, there probably aren't that many documented cases, but from the things that I've heard, that the most highly publicized cases of just in terms of court battles, that the kids end up not being horribly worse off. But Chuck, do you have anything
about that? I will plead it first.
You'll plead ignorance. Mm-hmm. But that's the one that I always want to take. Okay, so you want to talk about cloning.
Well, I just think that's the one that is the current one that I think of all these sort of raises all these scenarios that are very frightening on first exploration.
I think that all of them, and Tony would probably particularly point this out, but some of it I'm suspicious of because it's like the scientists wanting to prove that they can do it for just the purpose of proving that they can do it, rather than having it be for maybe a lofty reason. That's my suspicion, and I don't know if that's really true.
This is like with a premature baby. It's really good in the medical field to be the person who's kept the smallest preemie alive. And they haven't done this baby any good, but they did keep the smallest.
I think so that if you spoke to the scientists, and if you spoke to the physicians, they would have their feelings a little bit hurt because, I mean, they do get into this because they're truly interested in keeping kids alive. And there may be, I mean, I'm perfectly willing to say that lots of scientists have huge egos and stuff like that, but I think that that many of folks are truly interested in making it possible for people to have children, that many people are really interested in keeping children alive. For those of us on the outside, we may think that they get sort of carried away with it, but... How does cloning work? I'm not a scientist, but the basics of it would be that you can take an undifferentiated cell. We've always been able to do that. We've always had clones in the world, but we call them identical twins. What's new about cloning these days is that you can take, this is where the technology will most likely go, is that you can take an adult, take Sandy, and we can take a bit of her skin off, and we can take that cell, and we can do funky things to it, and we can have it turn into another human being that is genetically almost identical to Sandy. There can be some differences just in terms of the egg that she's put into, and the embryonic fluid and all that sort of stuff, but that's not a big deal. So she will essentially have somebody who will look just like her, who will have all the same genes as she has. But the difference we have always been able to split embryos. So you could, with in vitro fertilization, you have a petri dish, and you could split something, and you could create identical twins. So that's technically cloning, because you have two things that were genetically the same. What this sort of cloning, in terms of Dolly the sheep, is that you can take just a bit of her and then create another sheep that is genetically identical.
Well, that's what I think. I mean, you're right technically, but the first one doesn't replicate an already adult being. I think what we're talking about cloning here, what we're talking about is replicating a being that's already reached adulthood and then returning it.
Yes, but I was talking about in terms of specifically what cloning means is the genetic.
And there's actually kind of a very, very recent twist on it that has a very low success rate. But as far as the cloning of male individuals, some geneticists, someplace or other, I think Great Britain, has successfully done this with male mice. And for some reason, there's more difficulty in cloning males than cloning females. It's worked both ways now.
Yeah, most people think that it's just a matter of time, that we will be able to clone humans, and that, so it's just a while.
Yeah, in that sense, it seems much different than the fertility thing. And some doctors who are doing fertility, our fertility specialists, would say, you know, it's different trying to create a child out of it. Egg and a sperm, and when you're cloning, who are you going to be cloning? The mother or the father? And so then the mother is raising, you know, someone really in a way her identical twin, even though, yeah, the environment will be different. And what ramifications does that have of the father's relation to this girl? And so a lot of these, or the other way, you know, you're raising someone who has the genetic material of your husband, and you're sleeping with your husband. It's just some people say, wow, we're already so far with some of this in vitro. Why are we going that route for fertility? Okay, maybe other reasons. Maybe we need to, you know, preserve certain kinds of sheep for, you know, their wool, or we need to do other things with animals. But for human fertility and for the psychological issues, that doesn't seem to make sense. You know, and I think that's kind of interesting, aren't
you? Think of how bad you'd feel if you weren't chosen to be cloned.
I was just going to say, I also find it that's where stuff grotesque. I mean, cloning your husband and then raising it as your child. But you know, I think there will be people who will love Johnny so much, their little Johnny so much, that they want the insurance policy of Johnny cloned and banked in case Johnny gets run over by a truck. And I can understand that. I still think they would discover that it's very weird. But I think the most compelling argument for cloning is its medicinal therapeutic value in the cloning of stem cells, embryonic stem cells, which we now have the capacity to direct toward making, you know, new tissue, making new organs, and to be able to inject that in diseased portions of the brain or diseased portions of the heart and to rejuvenate those portions of the body. And I'll bet you everybody sitting around this table would be more than happy to have that if you were the one suffering from Alzheimer's or you're the one suffering from congenital heart disease. So,
Or your spouse.
Absolutely.
Well,
or your child.
Well, there is a distinction made in discussions between the cloning of organs and then the cloning of beings. Very few people have actually argued against the cloning of organs. At least I haven't run across anything. And even in the popular media, I don't see many people who argue much about this. This seems to be the major concern in terms of cloning people. There's not a huge amount in the literature that is actually opposed to this. But in terms of popular media, I mean, you get the movie Gattaca and all the horrors that are going to happen.
Yeah. Well, and Chuck, I think, was first.
Just as far as the issue of cloning beings, as far as the consequences argument, I mean, there's two big problems. There's the issue of, you know, cloning beings because I'd like spare parts for myself, thank you very much. And also the issue of cloning beings because I'd like to foster the master race. And yes, by the way, I'm going to be the master race, thank you very much.
Well, there are two problems with both of those arguments, and those are very common arguments. The one is the clone presumably will still have agency, will still have a brain, and so will still have all of the rights that any other human being would have. So merely the source or the cause of one's conception, one's conceptual circumstances, that sounds good, probably wouldn't be very relevant with regard to one's status as a person. So, I mean, even today, people will have children for the sole purpose of hoping that this child has the bone marrow of their child. Now, we wouldn't say that it's okay for somebody to have a child in the hopes that their heart, that child's heart, is a perfect match for their two-year-old. I mean, we'd say, okay, go ahead and do it, but we're not going to let you rip the heart out of that kid and put it into this kid, because even though that was your intent, once the child is born, that child has all the rights of any other child. It doesn't matter why the child came into being. In terms of creating a master race, that cloning is just a phenomenally unprofitable way of doing it. I mean, Hitler was able to try to create a master race, and he got a very well-functioning army, and he didn't need to use cloning at all. Young adolescents are typically very malleable. You don't need to create yourself over and over again to get a good master race going. And so there are a lot of, I mean, just in terms of efficiency, to sit around and wait 18 years for your master race to reach maturity is not the most efficient way to create a master race. Those are just some of that, but I think that those are very common arguments in terms of just all of the horrors that are going to happen. And those were very common arguments against in vitro fertilization, that you would just have test tubes all over the place and babies would be born and then they would have this little army. And I'm just not sure that that's a very, very cost-effective way to do things, because cloning and in vitro fertilization are certainly going to be more expensive than getting a bunch of women to be pregnant. I mean, either way, you're going to need somebody to gestate these things. It seems it would be significantly cheaper to do it a different way.
One thing you didn't bring up is pre-implantation diagnosis. It kind of gets in between the in vitro fertilization and cloning, where you can actually diagnose, well, for instance, if you're going to cystic fibrosis, Huntington's, things that you could then not implant that cycle.
In vitro gene therapy.
Gene therapy would be, right now they can just tell whether or not it's going to have something and not implant it, but now, there's gene therapy possible.
Well, that's actually one of the arguments for cloning, is that you can get And this goes back to the argument that Marcia put forward against some sort of donation from outside the marriage. This way, what you can get, because some people argue that by having a third person involved in the genetic contribution, that's to committing adultery. With cloning, you can keep the third person out. So if your partner has some sort of genetic disease or simply has some other reproductive problem, cloning can be a way for people to have their own biological children without having to have anybody donate from the outside. So that's actually one of the arguments for it. Jim?
I was just going to say, on our list there of arguments against these technologies, I just thought of one as we started talking about cloning, and that's the argument that all of these technologies eventually serve to commodify human life and to violate human dignity so that people become treated as means towards ends, not ends in themselves.
And that's what, yeah.
What's that?
My personal expression, I thought that was the very best
argument. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I realize we're focusing on human stuff here, but Marcia's comment made me think about it too, is I find it troubling that we always make this huge divide between what we're willing to do to all other forms of life. And so all these things are perfectly acceptable to do on animals for our own ends, and we have a very utilitarian attitude towards anything that's not human life. But I also, this whole question about, you know, at what point, I know there are weaknesses with slippery slope arguments, but at what point do you start saying we're increasingly just seeing utilitarian or ways of thinking about reproduction of human life and I would argue other lives too, but so that now we just simply are in charge of programming the kind of life that can exist on the planet, whether it's vegetable, animal, or human. And I know that that's problematic if you find that playing God, and I just think there's other issues that are very troubling for me in that. And part of it is when we simply reduce it to the right of any couple to make a decision for themselves. If the technology exists located simply in the couple's ability to make the decision, that's what we open ourselves up to.
And that's what I mean, and I do think it's important to look at what the underlying attitudes are and say, are these the sorts of attitudes that we ought to be positively reinforcing?
If you remember our session the other day with Joel Loinus, we cows really strongly argued against all of this because we want to live a more natural life. But one of the things that concerns me is that we need biodiversity, and I can just see if we do enough of this, we're going to get away from the diversity. But that would probably take a long time.
Well, I think with regard to animals, that's probably a greater concern.
That's happening with the horses and dogs, definitely.
In terms of cloning, I could see us doing that with non-humans much more freely. My suspicion with cloning is that most human beings are going to just find it weird. So we're going to be unlikely to do it except in the most extreme cases. So I suspect that there isn't going to be that much of a threat to biodiversity, and it's probably not much more of a threat than there already is, just in terms of most people who have children are remarkably similar to one another. And I suspect that if we looked across population changes, we're probably, as a species, in terms of human beings, we probably are losing biodiversity. That's a guess. I have absolutely no evidence to back that up whatsoever. But it seems to me that in terms of human beings, that cloning isn't going to pose much of a threat to biodiversity.
I was liking what you were saying, Ben, about the animals too, because we have talked about the issue of suffering in relation to cloning, because people are saying it'll take us a while to perfect this, and it certainly will perfect it, but in the meantime, there's a lot of suffering of these animals and then potentially children because it doesn't work out. Some of them start to grow, then they don't grow. And related to that, this commodification of children, I just like to think about what it is people are trying to accomplish so much. And we have such a strong desire for our own biological children. And I feel this way too. I feel this way very strongly. But it's funny, if you start thinking of children all made in the image of God, and what is it about this that we need this quality child? We need this kind of market where we've got to have this biological child. It's got to be the quality child. He's got to have this quality genetic makeup. And it, we kind of, it's so easy to fall into that kind of thinking. I don't know, people.
Well, there's also the question with regard to the classification of children of whether these technologies are necessarily going to lead to the commodification of children, because many people have argued that these don't necessarily lead to any more commodification of children than having children the non-technological way. I mean, I know lots of kids who were put through the best private schools and were expected to be perfect and all this other sort of stuff. So many folks have argued that this technology could be used without commodifying children, but that we really need to guard against the commodification of children.
I think one reason why people want very healthy, ideal children, Marcia, is because the ones that they would get otherwise through adoption, for example, may come with lots of problems that have a price tag. And we live in a culture that you're on your own. You know, here's your house, there's your door. You keep your problems to yourself. And the reality is there aren't that many people in the world ready to help you or to help us care for this difficult child, or this child that may not be difficult, but just simply sick and have lots of problems that are expensive. And so, at least I sense some of that being part of it, that people, it may not be the expense as much as it is the time and the energy. And so in our culture where we're kind of on our own, you kind of want the child that's going to cause the least amount of problems and have the best chance of success, and that leads people to avoid adopting children that would seem to be burdens.
And do you think it can have anything to do with the fact that parents may feel judged by who their children are? So that if you have a child who is less than perfect, then that says something about you as a parent?
I think it has to do with under the best circumstances. Parenting is the hardest thing you'll ever do. And under the best circumstances. And when you have a child with other problems, this just makes it even harder.
Although not always. Sometimes people that have a child with a chronic illness or something major, somehow that family becomes more strong. I don't think it's the elimination of problems, but maybe we naturally look for that, but it isn't always how to have a happy life.
Jen, I know you're helping me on this in terms of really pushing us to think through these technologies in themselves, so that we aren't looking for, I mean, we aren't bringing up false arguments for why we need more or not. But these are ones that I find it very difficult to imagine or think through the morality of them without simultaneously thinking through the implications of the current cultural, political, economic context, because it just seems to me our pattern of the last century, and you were very successful, I think, in showing this in our the other night, is that once this technology becomes available, it will be used in a commodifying fashion. I mean, it will be used in a markets-oriented thing. It will be developed free of many of those different constraints. And so to not think through the implications of what that means for families, but also communities and nations and then global, it's really hard for me to evaluate these apart from the context in which they will take place.
One of the things I think is going on here is that there are many different questions to look at in terms of the moral permissibility of these things. There's the personal question of whether I, as an individual with my partner, should use any of these to have a child. And so whether it would be moral for me to do this or for me to not do this. Then there's the question of whether or not this is good social policy. You know, whether we should, as a community, as a nation, whether we should support this. Okay. If the government should give funding for it, if the government should pass laws against it. That's at a much higher level. Then there's the question of if we should be devoting any energy to researching this, And so I think that often as we discuss these things, they get all pulled in together. And so I think that the social, economic, and political situation is really important in terms of policy. But I suspect that if you talk to many individuals who are agonizing over not having children, that's probably not going to be a very compelling argument for them. That it's a bad argument in terms of policy, but in terms of particular individuals who have been trying and are heartbroken because they can't have a kid, they're going to say, yeah, right, whatever. We want a child. We love a child. We will do anything we can to get a child, and we will love that child no matter how that child ends up.
But I agree with that fully, but what I'm also saying is that it's very hard to predict the cumulative effect of lots of those different individual things. And I guess maybe this analogy is not helpful, not exact, but I think about, you know, what's going on in my part of the country, Midwest, with genetic alteration of crops and agriculture. And you can make all sorts of things about this individual farmer should have the right to do this and this. But the net effect is fundamentally transforming agriculture towards agribusiness, monocropping, loss of diversity, forcing small farmers out, poor land stewardship. And you can say, we should never stop research on agriculture and genetics. We should never, you know, forbid the market to try and test this out and stuff. But at some point, you pass a point where lots of individual decisions add up to major social ramifications, and therefore, you know, these individual choices to do something do end up impinging on other people's things because society is fundamentally reshaped. And I don't know whether that's a fair parallel for what could happen with this or not.
I think it could be, and I don't think that we can look into the future, at least I can't, with enough confidence to know what's going to happen. But you do run into the question then of, is the right to have children the sort of right that we say people have and should be allowed to have, damn the consequences? We do think that to be true with regard to some rights, like the right to free speech. The right to free speech, we say people have the right to free speech and they can exercise that right. A bunch of individuals can exercise that right to the detriment of all of society, but we protect that right. Even if protecting the right means that all of society will be hurt, because we believe the right to free speech is so fundamental to what it means to be a person with dignity that we're willing to protect that right even at the cost of harm to society. So the question that I think Dan is pushing us towards is the question of, is the right to have one's own biological children this sort of right? Is it the sort of right that ought to be protected, that people ought to be able to exercise from what may?
Two comments on that. One is that that's a positive right as opposed to a negative right. Even that right, free speech, is limited. You know, it's the famous shouting fire in the crowded theater. So your rights are curtailed when they interfere or contravene or trample someone else's rights.
So,
where is it going here? The interesting thing is a friend of Dan and I know a guy, Jim Nash, who actually disputes the claim that human beings have a right. He disputes the UN's Declaration of Human Rights, which says that, I forget which one it is, but it says that human beings have the right to determine the number and spacing of their children. He argues that you don't have a positive right, which is a chance to do a freedom for reproduction in this case, but instead he says, human beings have a negative right with regard to reproduction. You have a freedom from being forced to reproduce. So he would argue that what we've been assuming is wrong, that human beings don't, by nature, necessarily have a right to reproduce. You have a right to be free from being forced to do so. I'm not sure that, Matt, you know, that really helps or not, but but what I want to come back to then is, let's say we do have this positive freedom to reproduce. China is a different culture, obviously, and they decided that individual liberties left to their own individual decisions can harm the common good. And because of that, they invoked increasingly more severe population policies to restrict the number of children that would be born. They decided to curtail those rights at some point when the exercise of those liberties got to the point where they actually harmed the common good. But you'd have to be able to prove, I think, that these assisted means of reproduction are in fact harming the common good. And so I don't know. I don't know how many births in the United States, for example, take place through assisted reproduction. Do you, anybody know that? What percent? And I'm sure we'd be the leader, except for other rich European nations.
No, but I think the issue is more, there's only so much money in the pot, and so when you're taking money and putting it into reproductive technology, you're taking money away from vaccinations or from well child care and things that are going to save lives. So,
but my understanding,
public funds.
But my understanding is very few public funds go for any of this. Am I right about that?
Right now, right.
Yeah, and I would oppose that. I would agree with you. I don't want to see this happen, and then vaccinations not happen.
But public, as far as private and public insurance, that's the way our insurance. I mean, looked at the insurance bill lately, how much it costs them to buy insurance, and part of that insurance money is going
just for this. I understand. And frankly, I think that we should.
Okay. But not all insurance people, that's for sure. Only some.
But it's funny, I think. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Marcia.
Oh, just again about the money. It seems that, I don't know, for me, it seems just more complex. Like money for seeing what's going on in your body, you have closed tubes. You know, that's like, okay, somebody may pay, you know, what's wrong with your erections? I mean, we're going to find that out. I don't know. There's something, why can't the insurance pay for that? Those simple procedures about finding out, many insurance companies do not, because it's related to fertility. When we'll pay for anything else, I don't know. It seems like it's, again, graduated. What would be wrong? And there seems to be some agreement about artificial insemination with a couple legged sperm in vitro. That it can really help a few problems where, like, the tubes are closed. There's no way an egg's going to come down there. Why not allow that couple to be able to? So I don't know. Some of that seems a little more complex to me.
The diagnosis is cheap compared to the treatment.
Mm-hmm. Although sometimes the diagnosis can be very expensive for people.
It's going to be very difficult, though, to tell private insurance companies that they can't cover certain things. I mean, what the government has done is they said that private insurance companies have a responsibility to cover certain things, but I don't think any law has been passed that says that private insurance companies can't cover something if they don't want to. So if your insurance company does cover fertility treatments and you don't want to participate in that, you can just change insurance companies. I think it would be really difficult to pass laws telling insurance companies you can't pay for fertility treatments. I doubt that would fly in society as it stands right now. Dan, you want to say something?
Well, I don't even know how to frame the question, but it also has to do with my concern. When you were talking about the positive right for human beings to have children, and but that would only be infringed if you could demonstrate, you know, a direct harm. But I mean,
a direct
and unavoidable harm. And in some ways, I think that's what's, if we think, I also want us to be thinking ecologically when we think morally, and not just simply in terms of human realm. And Jim, do you know what the current statistics are about what percentage of the total biomass of the Earth now is being directed towards the human species? I mean, we continue to increase, we've got drastic decrease in biodiversity, drastic decrease in ecological harm, because, and it's not only human numbers, I know, but a lot of things that go with that. And when we don't ever think in a broader ecological context about these positive human rights, then what happens is all these individual decisions do add up to very direct and avoidable harm.
But the concern there that I have is that then people who are infertile are going to bear the brunt of social policy and say, well, look, the fact that you're not able to have children means we're going to target you first for not having children. I think population control is a very serious concern, but to me, this sort of thing, concern ought to be spread out among all of the population instead of focusing on a select class that has been unfortunate enough.
No, I'm not arguing that, but I was saying if you're going to argue, start with a positive human right to reproduce, and that then becomes a partial justification for this, I'm concerned about building that positive human right to reproduce.
Coming
from a family of 7 kids, I mean, I recognize what that means. But
I think that, I mean, I'm certainly not defending the positive right to have one's own children, but I think that it is one of the assumptions that we have in society, that everybody has this right. And so it's very difficult to work against it. It's very difficult to articulate why people have this right. But if you ever try and challenge that people don't have the right to have their own children, people look at you like,
watch
you're
out.
Evil, and you get hate mail. Not that I've experienced that already. But I think that's just in terms of the right to have one's own children is what underlies all of this, and what makes it very difficult to say that some fertility treatments are okay, but other fertility treatments are not okay. Because if you push people on it hard enough, it's going to be, well, why is artificial insemination and IVF okay for these people, but it's not okay for the people, but cloning won't be okay for these other people. I think that's one of the big concerns. We are out of time, so the tape can shut off now. And I think next time, if I remember correctly, I'm going to be talking about computers and ethics, and we'll be talking about artificial intelligence, artificial life, and some social justice concerns. I'll try to get all my hands into this.